理课堂听 class.com。
Passage 2. Individuals differ greatly in the degree in which culture shock affects them. Although not common, there are individuals who cannot live in foreign countries. However, those who have seen people go through shock and onto a satisfactory adjustment can discern steps in the process.During the first stage, most individuals are fascinated by the new. They stay in hotels and associate with nationals who speak their language, and are polite and gracious to foreigners. This honeymoon stage may last from a few days or weeks to 6 months, depending on circumstances. If one is very important, he or she will be shown the places, will be spoiled and petted.And in a press interview will speak glowingly about goodwill and international friendship. But this mentality does not normally last if the foreign visitor remains abroad and has seriously to cope with real conditions of life. It is then that the second stage begins, characterized by the hostile and aggressive attitudes towards the host country.This hostility eventually grows out of the genuine difficulty which the visitor experiences in the process of adjustment. There are house troubles, transportation troubles, shopping troubles, and the fact that people in the host country are largely indifferent to all these troubles. They help, but they don't understand your great concern over these difficulties.Therefore, they must be insensitive and unsympathetic to you and your worries. The result, you just don't like them. You become aggressive. You band together with others from your country and criticize the host country, its ways and its people. But this criticism is not an objective appraisal.
Individuals differ greatly in the degree in which culture shock affects them. Although not common, there are individuals who cannot live in foreign countries. However, those who have seen people go through shock and onto a satisfactory adjustment can discern steps in the process. During the first stage, most individuals are fascinated by the new.They stay in hotels and associate with nationals who speak their language and are polite and gracious to foreigners. This honeymoon stage may last from a few days or weeks to 6 months, depending on circumstances. If one is very important, he or she will be shown the places, will be spoiled and petted, and in a press interview will speak glowingly about goodwill and international friendship.But this mentality does not normally last if the foreign visitor remains abroad and has seriously to cope with real conditions of life. It is then that the second stage begins, characterized by a hostile and aggressive attitude towards the host country. This hostility evidently grows out of the genuine difficulty which the visitor experiences in the process of adjustment. There are house troubles, transportation troubles, shopping troubles, and the fact that people in the host country are largely indifferent to all these troubles.They help, but they don't understand your great concern over these difficulties. Therefore, they must be insensitive and unsympathetic to you and your worries. The result? You just don't like them. You become aggressive. You band together with others from your country and criticize the host country, its way, and its people. But this criticism is not an objective appraisal.
Individuals differ greatly in the degree in which culture shock affects them. Although not common, there are individuals who cannot live in foreign countries. However, those who have seen people go through shock and onto a satisfactory adjustment can discern steps in the process. During the first stage, most individuals are fascinated by the new. They stay in hotels and associate with nationals who speak their language, and are polite and gracious to foreigners. This honeymoon stage may last from a few days or weeks to 6 months, depending on circumstances. If one is very important, he or she will be shown the places, will be spoiled and petted, and in a press interview will speak glowingly about goodwill and international friendship. But this mentality does not normally last if the foreign visitor remains abroad and has seriously to cope with real conditions of life. It is then that the second stage begins, characterized by the hostile and aggressive attitudes towards the host country. This hostility eventually grows out of the genuine difficulty which the visitor experiences in the process of adjustment. There are house troubles, transportation troubles, shopping troubles, and the fact that people in the host country are largely indifferent to all these troubles. They help, but they don't understand your great concern over these difficulties. Therefore, they must be insensitive and unsympathetic to you and your worries. The result, you just don't like them. You become aggressive. You band together with others from your country and criticize the host country, its ways and its people. But this criticism is not an objective appraisal.
Passage 3. Wisconsin has become one of the richest dairy regions in the world over the past 150 years, and we are proud of that. Yet, this state's dairy industry is not about what was, but what is yet to come. When you look beyond some of the numbers, there's a very encouraging story. Despite the fact that we have lost some 60% of the family farms in Wisconsin over the past 25 years, we produce more milk with fewer cows. Our farms are more efficient and are led by progressive, forward-thinking professionals who believe that this state will continue to be a world-class base from which to operate. Our cheesemakers are unequaled. The dairy industry nationally is threatened by challenges. We are faced with confusing dietary guidelines and by special interest groups, trying to distort our well-earned image of producing safe, nutritious products of quality. We understand, however, that as the responsibilities of production fall into fewer hands, as has been the case in this country since the 1920s, the need to educate consumers increases. This fall, Wisconsin's dairy farmers kick off a campaign to remind people of dairy's contribution to not only our state's economy, but also to our history and to the very social fabric of our state. We will produce a series of ads reminding urban consumers of dairy's role in the good life in Wisconsin, and will communicate with our state's leading decision makers regarding the economic and social impact dairy has made and will continue to make. This effort is an attempt to educate everyone in Wisconsin, still America's dairyland, that when you live in Wisconsin, you're part of the dairy industry, and we all will play a role in its future.
Wisconsin has become one of the richest dairy regions in the world over the past 150 years, and we are proud of that. Yet this state's dairy industry is not about what was, but about what is yet to come. When you look beyond some of the numbers, there's a very encouraging story. Despite the fact that we have lost some 60% of the family farms in Wisconsin over the past 25 years, we produce more milk with fewer cows. Our farms are more efficient and are led by progressive, forward-thinking professionals who believe that this state will continue to be a world-class base from which to operate. Our cheesemakers are unequaled. The dairy industry nationally is threatened by challenges. We are faced with confusing dietary guidelines and by special interest groups trying to distort our well-earned image of producing safe, nutritious products of quality. We understand, however, that as the responsibilities of productions fall into fewer hands, as has been the case in this country since the 1920s, the need to educate consumers increases. This fall, Wisconsin's dairy farmers kick off a campaign to remind people of dairy's contribution to not only our state's economy, but also to our history and to the very social fabric of our state. We will produce a series of ads reminding urban consumers of dairy's role in the good life in Wisconsin, and we'll communicate with our state's leading decision makers regarding the economic and social impact dairy has made and will continue to make. This effort is an attempt to educate everyone in Wisconsin, still America's dairyland, that when you live in Wisconsin, you're part of the dairy industry, and we all will play a role in its future.
Wisconsin has become one of the richest dairy regions in the world over the past 150 years, and we are proud of that. Yet this state's dairy industry is not about what was, but what is yet to come. When you look beyond some of the numbers, there's a very encouraging story. Despite the fact that we have lost some 60% of the family farms in Wisconsin over the past 25 years, we produce more milk with fewer cows. Our farms are more efficient and are led by progressive, forward-thinking professionals who believe that this state will continue to be a world-class base from which to operate. Our cheesemakers are unequaled. The dairy industry nationally is threatened by challenges. We are faced with confusing dietary guidelines and by special interest groups trying to distort our well-earned image of producing safe, nutritious products of quality. We understand, however, that as the responsibilities of production fall into fewer hands, as has been the case in this country since the 1920s, the need to educate consumers increases. This fall, Wisconsin's dairy farmers kick off a campaign to remind people of dairy's contribution to not only our state's economy, but also to our history and to the very social fabric of our state. We will produce a series of ads reminding urban consumers of dairy's role in the good life in Wisconsin, and will communicate with our state's leading decision makers regarding the economic and social impact dairy has made and will continue to make. This effort is an attempt to educate everyone in Wisconsin, still America's Dairyland. That, when you live in Wisconsin, you're part of the dairy industry, and we all will play a role in its future.
Passage 4. The World Bank is offering money for new ideas to improve life in developing nations. People could receive as much as $200,000 for creative projects to ease the effects of poverty. About every 18 months, the World Bank holds a competition called the Development Marketplace. Finalists chosen in different countries gather in Washington, D.C. The competitors explain their ideas to groups that can provide financial and technical support. The winners, chosen in Washington, are given startup money to carry out their plan within 1 year. This year, the World Bank says the Development Marketplace has $4 million to give away to entrepreneurs. They must find new, low-cost ways to bring water, waste control, and energy to people who lack these services. Anyone can compete in the Development Marketplace. Ideas must be designed to improve the lives of the poor. Also, other people must be able to copy the idea in other communities. The World Bank says the competition looks for ideas that others may dismiss as too unusual or too small to consider seriously. Judges from the World Bank and other organizations choose the winners. At the last Development Marketplace in 2003, researchers from Tanzania won money for training rats to identify tuberculosis. Another winner was a Vietnamese professor, Tran Thiet, who proposed to teach farmers how to harvest grass from the wetland areas without harming the environment. Proposals must be received by 23 hours universal time on November 30th. The winners will be announced on May 9th, 2006.
The World Bank is offering money for new ideas to improve life in developing nations. People could receive as much as $200,000 for creative projects to ease the effects of poverty. About every 18 months, the World Bank holds a competition called the Development Marketplace. Finalists, chosen in different countries, gather in Washington, D.C. The competitors explain their ideas to groups that can provide financial and technical support. The winners, chosen in Washington, are given startup money to carry out their plans within 1 year. This year, the World Bank says the Development Marketplace has $4 million to give away to entrepreneurs. They must find new, low-cost ways to bring water, waste control, and energy to people who lack these services. Anyone can compete in the Development Marketplace. Ideas must be designed to improve the lives of the poor. Also, other people must be able to copy the idea in other communities. The World Bank says that the competition looks for ideas that others may dismiss as too unusual or too small to consider seriously. Judges from the World Bank and other organizations choose the winners. At the last Development Marketplace in 2003, researchers from Tanzania won money for training rats to identify tuberculosis. Another winner was a Vietnamese professor, Tran Thiet. He proposed to teach farmers how to harvest grass from a wetland area without harming the environment. Proposals must be received by 23 hours Universal Time on November the 30th. The winners will be announced on May the 9th, 2006.
The World Bank is offering money for new ideas to improve life in developing nations. People could receive as much as $200,000 for creative projects to ease the effects of poverty. About every 18 months, the World Bank holds a competition called the Development Marketplace. Finalists chosen in different countries gather in Washington, D.C. The competitors explain their ideas to groups that can provide financial and technical support. The winners, chosen in Washington, are given startup money to carry out their plan within 1 year. This year, the World Bank says the Development Marketplace has $4 million to give away to entrepreneurs. They must find new, low-cost ways to bring water, waste control, and energy to people who lack these services. Anyone can compete in the development marketplace. Ideas must be designed to improve the lives of the poor. Also, other people must be able to copy the idea in other communities. The World Bank says the competition looks for ideas that others may dismiss as too unusual or too small to consider seriously. Judges from the World Bank and other organizations choose the winners. At the last development marketplace in 2003, researchers from Tanzania won money for training rats to identify tuberculosis. Another winner was a Vietnamese professor, Tran Thiet, who proposed to teach farmers how to harvest grass from the wetland areas without harming the environment. Proposals must be received by 23 hours Universal Time on November 30th. The winners will be announced on May 9th, 2006.
Passage 5. Six organizations in the United States say they will provide $200 million for higher education in Africa. The money is to be spent over the next 5 years to support universities in seven African countries. Kofi Annan spoke at the announcement of the $200 million commitment to strengthen higher education in seven African countries. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan joined leaders of the six foundations in their announcement. He said African universities are important to the continent's future development, governance, and peace. The new investment includes more than $5 million to provide faster computer links to the internet at a reduced cost. The foundations entered into an agreement with the satellite operator, Intelsat, to provide the service. Four of the foundations involved in the new project began to work together to support African universities in 2000. The Carnegie Corporation and the Ford, MacArthur and Rockefeller foundations joined to create the Partnership for Higher Education in Africa. The partnership says it has provided more than $150 million so far. The money has gone for universities. Foundation officials report much progress over the past 5 years. Examples include the creation of the Journal of Higher Education in Africa, which is a place for experts to share ideas and discuss issues facing African higher education. The partnership has also provided more than $10 million to help almost 1,000 women attend African universities. Foundation officials say the partnership will help Africa's young people get the education they need to prepare them to lead their nations into the future.
Six organizations in the United States say they will provide $200 million for higher education in Africa. The money is to be spent over the next 5 years to support universities in seven African countries. Kofi Annan spoke at the announcement of the $200 million commitment to strengthen higher education in 7 African countries. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan joined leaders of the 6 foundations in the announcement. He said African universities are important to the continent's future development, governance and peace. The new investment includes more than $5 million to provide faster computer links to the internet at a reduced cost. The foundations entered into an agreement with the satellite operator Intelsat to provide the service. 4 of the foundations involved in the new project began to work together to support Africa's universities in 2000. The Carnegie Corporation and the Ford, MacArthur and Rockefeller Foundation joined to create the Partnership for Higher Education in Africa. The partnership says it has provided more than $150 million so far. The money has gone for universities. Foundation officials report much progress over the past 5 years. Examples include the creation of the Journal of Higher Education in Africa, which is a place for experts to share ideas and discuss issues facing African higher education. The partnership also has provided more than $10 million to help almost 1,000 women attend African universities. Foundation officials say the partnership will help Africa's young people get the education they need to prepare them to lead their nation into the future.
Six organizations in the United States say they will provide $200 million for higher education in Africa. The money is to be spent over the next 5 years to support universities in 7 African countries. Kofi Annan spoke at the announcement of the $200 million commitment to strengthen higher education in 7 African countries. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan joined leaders of the 6 foundations in their announcement. He said African universities are important to the continent's future development, governance and peace. The new investment includes more than $5 million to provide faster computer links to the internet at a reduced cost. The foundations entered into an agreement with the satellite operator Intelsat to provide the service. 4 of the foundations involved in the new project began to work together to support African universities in 2000. The Carnegie Corporation and the Ford, MacArthur and Rockefeller foundations joined to create the Partnership for Higher Education in Africa. The partnership says it has provided more than $150 million so far. The money has gone for universities. Foundation officials report much progress over the past 5 years. Examples include the creation of the Journal of Higher Education in Africa, which is a place for experts to share ideas and discuss issues facing African higher education. The partnership has also provided more than $10 million to help almost 1,000 women attend African universities. Foundation officials say the partnership will help Africa's young people get the education they need to prepare them to lead their nations into the future.
Passage 6. Since ancient times, farmers have chosen the seeds for the coming year for the biggest and best plants in their crop. The hope is that these seeds will have the same good qualities as their parent plants. This method is called inbreeding, but experts say it is not the best way to develop seeds with strong, healthy qualities over time. In 1906, the genetic researcher G.H. Shaw started work on breeding corn in New York State. He found that if he mated two inbred groups of corn plants, he could create a stronger new line of corn. This process is called crossbreeding. It produces hybrids from putting together different kinds of related plants. Researchers soon recognized that they could crossbreed four inbred lines of corn. The result is stronger than corn crossbred only once. Hybrid corn first came forth in 1921. Today, almost all corn planted in the United States is hybrid. And farmers harvest about 7 times more corn from each hectare than they did 70 years ago. Corn is not the only hybrid crop. Yuan Longping is called the father of hybrid rice. He and other Chinese scientists worked on the idea in the 1960s and 70s. The first hybrid rice appeared in 1974. Mr. Yuan used 3 lines of parent seeds that produced 15 to 20% more grain. By 1995, half of all the rice grown in China was hybrid. Hybrids are not the answer to every problem in agriculture. Hybrids can take many years to develop. New hybrid seeds must be bought each year. They also cost more than other seeds. And not all crops can be crossbred successfully. But hybrids have been an important development for productivity.
Since ancient times, farmers have chosen the seeds for the coming year from the biggest and best plants in their crop. The hope is that these seeds will have the same good qualities as their parent plants. This method is called inbreeding. But experts say it is not the best way to develop seeds with strong, healthy qualities over time. In 1906, the genetic researcher G.H. Shull started work on breeding corn in New York State. He found that if he mated 2 inbred groups of corn plants, he could create a stronger new line of corn. This process is called crossbreeding. It produces hybrids from putting together different kinds of related plants. Researchers soon recognized that they could crossbreed 4 inbred lines of corn. The result is stronger than corn crossbred only once. Hybrid corn first came forth in 1921. Today, almost all corn planted in the United States is hybrid. And farmers harvest about 7 times more corn from each hectare than they did 70 years ago. Corn is not the only hybrid crop. Yuan Longping is called the father of hybrid rice. He and other Chinese scientists worked on this idea in the 1960s and 70s. The first hybrid rice appeared in 1974. Mr. Yuan used 3 lines of parent seeds that produced 15 to 20% more grain. By 1995, half of all the rice grown in China was hybrid. Hybrids are not the answer to every problem in agriculture. Hybrids can take many years to develop. New hybrid seeds must be bought each year. They also cost more than other seeds. and not all crops can be crossbred successfully. But hybrids have been an important development for productivity.
Since ancient times, farmers have chosen the seeds for the coming year for the biggest and best plants in their crop. The hope is that these seeds will have the same good qualities as their parent plants. This method is called inbreeding, but experts say it is not the best way to develop seeds with strong, healthy qualities over time. In 1906, the genetic researcher G.H. Shaw started work on breeding corn in New York State. He found that if he mated two inbred groups of corn plants, he could create a stronger new line of corn. This process is called crossbreeding. It produces hybrids from putting together different kinds of related plants. Researchers soon recognized that they could crossbreed four inbred lines of corn. The result is stronger than corn crossbred only once. Hybrid corn first came forth in 1921. Today, almost all corn planted in the United States is hybrid. And farmers harvest about 7 times more corn from each hectare than they did 70 years ago. Corn is not the only hybrid crop. Yuan Longping is called the father of hybrid rice. He and other Chinese scientists worked on the idea in the 1960s and 70s. The first hybrid rice appeared in 1974. Mr. Yuan used 3 lines of parent seeds that produced 15 to 20% more grain. By 1995, half of all the rice grown in China was hybrid. Hybrids are not the answer to every problem in agriculture. Hybrids can take many years to develop. New hybrid seeds must be bought each year. They also cost more than other seeds, and not all crops can be crossbred successfully. But hybrids have been an important development for productivity.
Passage 7. The World Health Organization says people need more information about how to safely use traditional medicines. The WHO now has guidelines to suggest ways for public health officials to develop that information. The health agency is part of the United Nations. Up to 80% of people in developing countries depend on traditional medicines. More and more people in wealthy countries use them too. But the WHO notes that just because products are natural does not always mean they are safe. It says reports of bad reactions have increased sharply in the last few years. In China, for example, about 10,000 harmful drug reactions were reported in 2002. There were just 4,000 cases reported between 1990 and 1999. Traditional medicines are made from plants, animal products, and minerals. The health agency says they remain largely outside government control. In most countries, traditional medicines can be purchased without a doctor's order. Sometimes they are prepared by friends or by the patients themselves. The WHO says this situation raises concerns about the quality of treatments and the lack of professional supervision. Lee Jong-wook is Director General of the organization. Dr. Lee says the WHO supports the use of traditional medicines when they have been shown to help and to have few risks. But he says governments should have the tools to make sure people get the best information. Under the new guidelines, traditional healers would have to be skilled, and they would have to be listed with the government. Also, people would have to be informed about how and where to report problems. Dr. Lee says governments can also use the guidelines to create media campaigns about the issue.
The World Health Organization says people need more information about how to safely use traditional medicines. The WHO now has guidelines to suggest ways for public health officials to develop that information. The health agency is part of the United Nations. Up to 80% of people in developing countries depend on the traditional medicines. More and more people in wealthy countries use them too. But the WHO notes that just because products are natural does not always mean they are safe. It says reports of bad reactions have increased sharply in the last few years. In China, for example, about 10,000 harmful drug reactions were reported in 2002. There were just 4,000 cases reported between 1990 and 1999. Traditional medicines are made from plants, animal products and minerals. The health agency says they remain largely outside government control. In most countries, traditional medicines can be purchased without a doctor's order. Sometimes they are prepared by friends or by the patients themselves. The WHO says this situation raises concern about the quality of treatments and the lack of professional supervision. Lee Jong-wook is Director General of the organization. Dr. Lee says the WHO supports the use of traditional medicines when they have been shown to help and to have few risks. But he says governments should have the tools to make sure people get the best information. Under the new guidelines, traditional healers would have to be skilled. And they would have to be listed with the government. Also, people would have to be informed about how and where to report problems. Dr. Lee says governments can also use the guidelines to create media campaigns about the issue.
The World Health Organization says people need more information about how to safely use traditional medicines. The WHO now has guidelines to suggest ways for public health officials to develop that information. The health agency is part of the United Nations. Up to 80% of people in developing countries depend on traditional medicines. More and more people in wealthy countries use them too. But the WHO notes that just because products are natural does not always mean they are safe. It says reports of bad reactions have increased sharply in the last few years. In China, for example, about 10,000 harmful drug reactions were reported in 2002. There were just 4,000 cases reported between 1990 and 1999. Traditional medicines are made from plants, animal products, and minerals. The health agency says they remain largely outside government control. In most countries, traditional medicines can be purchased without a doctor's order. Sometimes they are prepared by friends or by the patients themselves. The WHO says this situation raises concerns about the quality of treatments and the lack of professional supervision. Lee Jong-wook is Director General of the organization. Dr. Lee says the WHO supports the use of traditional medicines when they have been shown to help and to have few risks. But he says governments should have the tools to make sure people get the best information. Under the new guidelines, traditional healers would have to be skilled, and they would have to be listed with the government. Also, people would have to be informed about how and where to report problems. Dr. Lee says governments can also use the guidelines to create media campaigns about the issue.
Passage 8. One afternoon recently, two unrelated friends called to tell me that, well, their marriage hadn't made it. One was leaving his wife for another woman. The other was leaving her husband because we thought it best. As always, after such increasingly common calls, I felt helpless and angry. What had happened to those solemn vows that they swore on their wedding ceremony? Given the era and their feelings, their decision probably made sense. What angers me was the loss of years and energy. It was an anger similar to that I feel when I abandon foundations of building projects. Piled bricks and girders and the gash in the ground left to depress the passerby. When our grandparents married, seldom couples divorced. As long as we both shall live was no joke. After their vows, couples learnt to live with each other, not necessarily because they love each other, but because they were stuck, and it was better to be stuck comfortably than otherwise. Most of the external pressures that helped to enforce our grandparents' vows have dissolved. Women can earn money and may enjoy sex, even bear children without marrying. As divorce becomes more common, some divorcees even argue that divorce is beneficial, educational, that the second or third marriage is the best, and the only reason left to marry is love. In some respects, this freedom can be seen as social progress. In some other respects, our rapidly rising divorce rate and the declining marriage rate represents a loss.
One afternoon recently, two unrelated friends called to tell me that, well, their marriages hadn't made it. One was leaving his wife for another woman. The other was leaving her husband because we thought it best. As always, after such increasingly common calls, I felt helpless and angry. What had happened to those solemn vows that they swore on their wedding ceremony? Given the era and their feelings, their decisions probably made sense. What angers me was the loss of years and energy. It was an anger similar to that I feel when I see abandoned foundations of building projects, piled bricks and girders, and a gash in the ground left to depress the passerby. When our grandparents married, seldom couples divorced. As long as we both shall live was no joke. After their vows, couples learned to live with each other, not necessarily because they love each other, but because they were stuck, and it was better to be stuck comfortably than otherwise. Most of the external pressures that helped to enforce our grandparents' vows have dissolved. Women can earn money and may enjoy sex, even bear children, without marrying. As divorce becomes more common, some divorcees even argue that divorce is beneficial, educational, that the second or third marriage is the best, and the only reason left to marry is love. In some respects, this freedom can be seen as social progress. In other respects, our rapidly rising divorce rate and the declining marriage rate represent a loss.
One afternoon recently, two unrelated friends called to tell me that, well, their marriage hadn't made it. One was leaving his wife for another woman. The other was leaving her husband because we thought it best. As always, after such increasingly common calls, I felt helpless and angry. What had happened to those solemn vows that they swore on their wedding ceremony? Given the era and their feelings, their decision probably made sense. What angers me was the loss of years and energy. It was an anger similar to that I feel when I abandon foundations of building projects. Piled bricks and girders and the gash in the ground left to depress the passerby. When our grandparents married, seldom couples divorced. As long as we both shall live was no joke. After their vows, couples learned to live with each other, not necessarily because they love each other, but because they were stuck, and it was better to be stuck comfortably than otherwise. Most of the external pressures that helped to enforce our grandparents' vows have dissolved. Women can earn money and may enjoy sex, even bear children without marrying. As divorce becomes more common, some divorcees even argue that divorce is beneficial, educational, that the second or third marriage is the best, and the only reason left to marry is love. In some respects, this freedom can be seen as social progress. In some other respects, our rapidly rising divorce rate and the declining marriage rate represents a loss.
Passage 9. Many people who are rich are also well known. Ted Sweeney was an exception to this rule. His family moved to San Francisco from Los Angeles when he was 1 month old. That's where he grew up. At the age of 17, he was hit by a train. Although he was not seriously hurt, the railroad paid him $25,000. Instead of going to college, he bought a small store. 6 months later, the government bought his land to build a new highway. He sold it for $95,000. With this money, he moved to Detroit. He started a small company that made parts for the car manufacturers. It was very successful, and by the time he was 23, he was a millionaire. When he was 24, he got married. He and his wife had 3 daughters in the next 5 years. By the time he was 30, he had over $10 million. Then tragedy struck. He was involved in a traffic accident. He did not die, but his wife and daughters did. 6 months later, he sold everything he owned and put his money in stocks. Ted then moved to New York. He lived for the next 40 years in a one-room apartment. He spent most of his days wandering through the city looking in garbage cans for food. He never cooked. He rarely talked to anyone except himself. Most people were afraid of him. His clothes were always old and dirty. Shortly before he died, he moved back to Los Angeles. After spending 2 weeks there, he was put in jail because he had no money and no job. City workers tried to help him. They offered him work, but he would not work. Towards the end, he would not talk to anyone at all. When he died, he was a lonely man. But someone remembered his name and knew he had lived in Detroit and had been successful. It was learned that he had put his stocks in a box at a Detroit bank. After they were sold and all the taxes paid, there was still over $100 million left.
Many people who are rich are also well known. Ted Sweeney was an exception to this rule. His family moved to San Francisco from Los Angeles when he was 1 month old. That's where he grew up. At the age of 17, he was hit by a train. Although he was not seriously hurt, the railroad paid him $25,000. Instead of going to college, he bought a small store. 6 months later, the government bought his land and built a new highway. He sold it for $95,000. With this money, he moved to Detroit. He started a small company that made parts for the car manufacturers. It was very successful, and by the time he was 23, he was a millionaire. When he was 24, he got married. He and his wife had three daughters in the next 5 years. By the time he was 30, he had over $10 million. Then tragedy struck. He was involved in a traffic accident. He did not die, but his wife and daughters did. 6 months later, he sold everything he owned and put his money in stocks. Ted then moved to New York. He lived for the next 40 years in a one-room apartment. He spent most of his days wandering through the city, looking in garbage cans for food. He never cooked. He rarely talked to anyone except himself. Most people were afraid of him. His clothes were always old and dirty. Shortly before he died, he moved back to Los Angeles. After spending 2 weeks there, he was put in jail because he had no money and no job. City workers tried to help him. They offered him work, but he would not work. Towards the end, he would not talk to anyone at all. When he died, he was a lonely man. But someone remembered his name and knew that he had lived in Detroit and had been successful. It was learned that he had put his stocks in a box at the Detroit bank. After they were sold and all the taxes paid, there was still over $100 million left.
Many people who are rich are also well known. Ted Sweeney was an exception to this rule. His family moved to San Francisco from Los Angeles when he was 1 month old. That's where he grew up. At the age of 17, he was hit by a train. Although he was not seriously hurt, the railroad paid him $25,000. Instead of going to college, he bought a small store. 6 months later, the government bought his land to build a new highway. He sold it for $95,000. With this money, he moved to Detroit. He started a small company that made parts for the car manufacturers. It was very successful, and by the time he was 23, he was a millionaire. When he was 24, he got married. He and his wife had three daughters in the next 5 years. By the time he was 30, he had over $10 million. Then tragedy struck. He was involved in a traffic accident. He did not die, but his wife and daughters did. 6 months later, he sold everything he owned and put his money in stocks. Ted then moved to New York. He lived for the next 40 years in a one-room apartment. He spent most of his days wandering through the city, looking in garbage cans for food. He never cooked. He rarely talked to anyone except himself. Most people were afraid of him. His clothes were always old and dirty. Shortly before he died, he moved back to Los Angeles. After spending 2 weeks there, he was put in jail because he had no money and no job. City workers tried to help him. They offered him work, but he would not work. Towards the end, he would not talk to anyone at all. When he died, he was a lonely man. But someone remembered his name and knew he had lived in Detroit and had been successful. It was learned that he had put his stocks in a box at a Detroit bank. After they were sold and all the taxes paid, there was still over $100 million left.
Passage 10. British people now have more free time and holiday than they did 20 years ago. The average number of working hours has fallen, and by the mid-1980s, Almost all full-time manual employees were entitled to 4 weeks' holiday or more, in addition to public holidays including Christmas and Easter. The increasing number of unemployed, particularly the young, means that large sections of the population have found themselves with more leisure time. Typically popular pastimes in the UK include listening to pop music, going to a bar, playing and watching sports, going on holiday, enjoying outdoor activities and watching TV. The number of people playing sports has risen, partly due to the availability of more sporting facilities, such as local leisure centres. As more people become aware of the necessity for exercise, it is estimated that 1/3 of the adult population regularly takes part in outdoor sports, and about 1/4 in indoor sports. Among the most popular sporting activities are walking, swimming, snooker and darts. Fishing is the most popular country sport. Football, cricket, horse racing and motorsports are all popular spectator sports. Many magazines are published which pertain to popular, the specialised sports and interest. Multi-screen cinemas have become more popular, and the number of people going to the cinema increased in the mid-1980s, after having fallen by more than a half between 1981 and 1984. This was because of a large increase in the popularity of
home videos.
Britain has one of the highest rates of home video ownership in the world.
British people now have more free time and holidays than they did 20 years ago. The average number of working hours has fallen, and by the mid-1980s, almost all full-time manual employees were entitled to 4 weeks' holiday or more, in addition to public holidays, including Christmas and Easter. The increasing number of unemployed, particularly the young, means that large sections of the population have found themselves with more leisure time. Typical popular pastimes in the UK include listening to pop music, going to a bar, playing and watching sports, going on holidays, enjoying outdoor activities and watching TV. The number of people playing sports has risen, partly due to the availability of more sporting facilities, such as local leisure centres. As more people become aware of the necessity for exercise, it is estimated that 1/3 of the adult population regularly takes part in outdoor sports, and about 1/4 in indoor sports. Among the most popular sporting activities are walking, swimming, snooker and darts. Fishing is the most popular country sport. Football, cricket, horse racing and motorsports are all popular spectator sports. Many magazines are published which pertain to popular and specialised sports and interests. Multi-screen cinemas have become more popular, and the number of people going to the cinema increased in the mid-1980s, after having fallen by more than a half between 1981 and 1984. This was because of a large increase in the popularity of home videos. Britain has one of the highest rates of home video ownership in the world.
British people now have more free time and holiday than they did 20 years ago. The average number of working hours has fallen, and by the mid-1980s, almost all full-time manual employees were entitled to 4 weeks' holiday or more, in addition to public holidays including Christmas and Easter. The increasing number of unemployed, particularly the young, means that large sections of the population have found themselves with more leisure time. Typically popular pastimes in the UK include listening to pop music, going to a bar, playing and watching sports, going on holiday, enjoying outdoor activities and watching TV. The number of people playing sports has risen, partly due to the availability of more sporting facilities, such as local leisure centres. As more people become aware of the necessity for exercise, it is estimated that 1/3 of the adult population regularly takes part in outdoor sports, and about 1/4 in indoor sports. Among the most popular sporting activities are walking, swimming, snooker and darts. Fishing is the most popular country sport. Football, cricket, horse racing and motorsports are all popular spectator sports. Many magazines are published which pertain to popular, the specialised sports and interest. Multi-screen cinemas have become more popular, and the number of people going to the cinema increased in the mid-1980s, after having fallen by more than a half between 1981 and 1984. This was because of a large increase in the popularity of home movies. Britain has one of the highest rates of home movie ownership in the world. ¶¶